Response of each ship was not to return fire, but to perform an emergency jump away to safety. The SD network AIs were disappointed that they had not destroyed their prey, and they shifted their focus to the other pair of battlecruisers, which also jumped away, just as 15 more plasma cannon satellites unmasked from stealth to fire bolts of hellish energy. The bolts passed harmlessly out into space, growing cold and thin as they faded into nothingness. Aboard his flagship, Kuhn watched the tactical display with satisfaction.
"Is that enough data for you?"
he asked quietly, without looking at his intelligence officer.
Yes, sir, the officer replied, the pink skin under his fur growing darker.
"Very well."
Kuhn almost looked bored, a carefully managed impression.
"All ships, fire at will."
Dangling the battlecruisers in front of the SD network was a deliberate ploy to get the network to shoot and reveal a pattern of the placement of the plasma cannon satellites. Based on the angles of the bolts fired at the battlecruisers, the powerful AIs of the 7th Fleet had gathered enough information to predict with better than 80% confidence the density of the network and location of the other orbiting cannons. Battleships began to systematically reduce the enemy SD network to scrap, and of course the enemy hit back. The battleships had one major advantage. They were ships, and therefore could move. At such short range, ducking out of the way of an incoming plasma bolt was not possible, so the ships relied on their ability to twist space-time and jump. Whenever a ship's shields were drained below a preset limit, that ship jumped away to be replaced by a ship awaiting its turn in the battle. The operation demonstrated the skill, discipline, and power of the 7th Fleet, and after a short time of watching things blow up, Kuhn became bored. Achieving space superiority around Stiglord was only a matter of time, and he wanted to get on with the next phase of the operation. Orbital bombardment of the planet's surface. Part of the information provided by the Torgala was the location of plasma cannon clusters on the surface. Technically, they were under the surface, and many of them also had stealth fields projecting false images to prevent detection. Each cluster consisted of three cannons plus a central control bunker. Even before the SD network was fully reduced to scrap, Kuhn turned his attention to targets on the surface with the plasma cannon clusters at the top of his priority list. The list included air bases, anti-aircraft missile batteries, power stations, and a host of other items that could threaten a landing force. But only the plasma cannons could seriously hurt a battleship. Accordingly, while his big ships were still far from the planet, four cannon clusters were targeted by railguns, and seconds later, fountains of dirt and melted rock rose into the air on boiling mushroom clouds. If the enemy was shocked that their secret cannons had been hit, they said nothing. They didn't have to. Kuhn contacted the Wirgalan authorities with an offer of practical mercy. Mercy, because unnecessary deaths could be avoided. Practical because his mercy had a purpose, to impress upon the Wirgalan that the 7th Fleet could do anything it wanted, while all they could do was drag out the situation and ensure needless deaths on both sides. He did not really expect the Wirgalan authorities to take the entirely reasonable step of meek surrender, but he figured it was worth a shot. His message included the coordinates of three intact plasma cannon clusters with a simple offer. His ships would hold fire for a short time so the crews and those control bunkers could escape. After the deadline passed, the 7th Fleet would open fire. As there was nothing useful the cannons could do, and as his ships were not actually in position to strike the targets immediately, the offer of mercy cost him nothing, and the enemy gained nothing by refusing. Of course, the response by the Wirgalan was for the 9 cannons of the 3 clusters to combine into a shot at one of his battleships. With the battleship more than a light second above the surface, its shields deflected the focused bolts, with only 3 shield generators being taken offline. The big ship rolled to protect its vulnerable side and maintained station, signaling to Kuhn that it was still combat effective. It signaled its effectiveness to the enemy by firing a railgun salvo at another cannon cluster, reducing it to 3 smoking holes in the ground.
"Let's try this again, shall we?"
Kuhn told his communications crew, and the offer of mercy was repeated,
this time giving the coordinates of three different cannon clusters and broadcasting the message on all frequencies. If the Wargalan authorities neglected to notify the crews in the bunkers about the first offer, those crews heard the second offer directly. The second offer achieved mixed results. Two cannon clusters opened fire on the ships high above in a futile and uncoordinated gesture of defiance. Kuhn's ships immediately struck those sites, turning the control bunkers into ash. The third cannon cluster held fire, and Kuhn watched with interest as six Wargalan came out of a concealed entrance to the bunker and ran as fast as their short tentacle legs could carry them. Scampering across fields, they took shelter in a forested area and were lost to sight.
Well, Kuhn could not decide whether he was gratified or surprised by the enemy's sensible action.
Surprise. It was definitely surprise.
I did not actually expect them to.
The three plasma cannons of that cluster fired, targeting Kuhn's own ship. Alarms blared, and the deck shook under his feet.
Sorry, sir, the fleet operations officer cringed as he spoke. I wanted to give them time to get clear. They must have set the cannons to fire on automatic before they abandoned the bunker. Lesson learned. I will not make that mistake again.
Do we know where they are now? Kuhn asked. That crew, I mean.
Not with any precision.
The ops officer shook his head.
No, not from here. Our sensors can't track such a small group. They are in the forest here somewhere.
He waved a hand over a tree-covered area that extended for several square kilometers.
Take it out.
Sir? The forest? The whole thing?
Bardin. Kuhn addressed the officer by name. If you are concerned about fleet headquarters complaining that you are wasting ordnance, I will sign for it.
Bardin stiffened.
That will not be necessary.
Kuhn lowered his voice, aware that some of the bridge crew were watching the discussion.
I want to send a message, Bardin. A very loud, clear and unmistakable message. Do not fuck with the Seventh Fleet.
Yes, sir.
The forest was struck first by speed of light maser beams from the flagship, quickly followed by railgun rounds that dawdled their way down through the atmosphere at only a fraction of light speed. Then came missiles boring a hole through the air at hypersonic velocity, burrowing deep into the ground before their warheads exploded. The flagship fired three salvos, the second and third of which merely caused the rubble to bounce in a different pattern. When the ship was done, the forest no longer existed, nor was there any trace that it had ever been there.
I think we got them, Bardin announced with satisfaction.
One side of Kuhn's mouth curled up in a short-lived smile.
Well, we tried to be reasonable.
Signal all ships. Commence full-scale bombardment.
Bardin nodded gravely as he watched flashes of light appear across the continent below, followed by the foaming tops of mushroom clouds covering the area.
Admiral, you will henceforth be known as Kuhn the Merciful.
Kuhn snorted and tilted his head.
Mercy is not usually administered by the Megaton.
Bardin shrugged.
There was a first time for everything.
9 hours after the Seventh Fleet arrived in orbit of Stiglord, only slightly more than an hour behind schedule, a frigate jumped away. The little ship performed three jumps, though only two were necessary. The additional passage through twisted space-time was to prevent the enemy from knowing the ship's destination. Assembled at the endpoint were the transport ships, where most of the landing force waited, the support ships that serviced the Seventh Fleet and contained the invasion force's supplies and equipment, and the all-important assault carriers. Packed into the carriers were the human, Verdkris, and Ajakai soldiers who had the dubious honor of being in the first wave. The frigate transmitted a burst signal from Admiral Kuhn to the assault carriers. Commence the assault landing. Aboard the assault carrier Tig McDonough, the most important thing Jesse did before the assault drop was to visit the head near his assigned bunk. That was the last thing he did before sealing up the torso of his skin suit, because it was one less thing he had to worry about. The sophisticated alien mech suit had the ability to handle bodily functions. It had to when the user was in a toxic atmosphere, or in no atmosphere at all. Still, a tactical pee before boarding the dropship was a good idea. and he reminded his squad to do the same. With that tradition taken care of, he made sure his squad was ready, that all their assigned gear was present, in proper working order and secured in its proper place. He anticipated no problems during preparations for the assault drop. The first time they practiced boarding their assigned dropship, there had, of course, been glitches. Soldiers could not find some of their gear, power cells were not fully charged, a couple rifles could not connect to the squad network and had to be repaired or swapped for new weapons. Any replacement gear had to be checked out. Rifles had to be linked to the user's suit computer and sighted in at the ship's range. None of the problems were unusual. Jesse would have worried if nothing had gone wrong, because in his experience, that meant karma was holding a nasty surprise for him later. The last four times they ran the exercise, it was nearly perfect, as well as Jesse could have hoped. The final two practice runs involved the entire ship's complement assembling in their assigned areas of the ship and proceeding to the docking bays, with a Ruhar crewman leading the way so stupid humans didn't get lost and fall into a reactor. That worked only as well as it could, given the complexity of the operation. Units got jammed up in narrow passageways and intermingled in intersections. The chaos could have been lessened if the Legion soldiers had been allowed to rely on guidance from their suit computers, but part of the exercise simulated a partial communications breakdown. To make the day even more fun for exasperated squad and platoon leaders, a few random dropships were designated to have equipment failures, requiring units to switch to their alternate assignments. In the end, it all got sorted out with more than an hour to spare, and Jesse was well pleased with the results. Even Sergeant Jates was not as grumpy as usual after the final dry run for the assault drop. That morning's boarding operation was no mere exercise. It was for real. The ship that humans called the Big Mac was going to war. Any glitches could have fatal consequences. Jesse worked with the leaders of the two fire teams in his squad, checking absolutely everything as they waited for the signal to leave their assembly area. Unlike on Fresno, the entire Alien Legion force was properly equipped for high-intensity combat. No one was under the illusion that the landing on Stiglord would be a simple peacekeeping operation. Each soldier had a Ruhar skin suit that, while old and certainly not state-of-the-art, was well-maintained, updated with the latest version of software, and perfectly serviceable. In addition to all the other crap on their belts and stuffed into their packs, each soldier also carried a rifle, three spare power cells, 260 rounds of rifle ammunition, and either four rockets or six grenades. Sergeants and officers were authorized to also carry a sidearm, but Jesse had chosen to replace that weight with another magazine of 52 explosive-tipped rounds and a rocket. If he got into trouble, he would rely on his durable Kristang rifle rather than a pistol of dubious value. His squad consisted of two fire teams, each with three soldiers led by a sergeant. One of the fire teams was tasked with an anti-aircraft mission, equipped with two Zinger missile launchers and six missiles. The squad's mission was to provide security for Perkins's headquarters unit, not to engage in offensive combat operations. Both Jesse and Jates thought that avoiding combat was a fine notion, if the enemy read that memo. If not, shit was gonna get real. The series of lights on the overhead of the passageway flashed to green at the same moment a chime sounded, and Jesse had his squad moving even before he heard the official announcement to commence the boarding phase of the operation. There were no screw-ups, and not much talk either. Soldiers kept their thoughts mostly to themselves as they marched toward the dropships that would carry them down to the surface, where their part in the fighting would begin. Filing up the back ramp of dropships that humans called dodos, the entire first wave was aboard with their gear stowed, 96 minutes before the assault carrier was scheduled to jump into orbit. No one got lost, no one puked from nervous tension, there were no glitches in equipment. 10 minutes after the squad was squared away, Perkins arrived with her headquarters team. She nodded to Jesse, and he returned the gesture. Then they waited. And waited. Jesse released people one at a time to use the dodo's bathroom until it was 24 minutes to the scheduled jump. With 18 minutes remaining, the external launch bay doors slid open and dropships began firing up their engines. Jesse saw an orange light on the bulkhead display. Some minor system was experiencing a glitch. Derek Bonsu strode out of the cockpit, pulled open an access door in the cabin's floor and did something. The light changed from orange to green.
"Is that a problem, sir?"
Jesse asked, his voice betraying more nerves than he wanted his team to hear. Flying was not his favorite thing to do. He preferred his boots to be solidly on the ground.
"Nah," Derek shook his head. "Sensor showed our starboard landing gear isn't locked, and I know it is, so I disconnected the sensor. We'll be fine, Sergeant."
Aboard a dropship in a launch bay of the assault carrier Dahl Ternodden, Captain Danielle Grace waited until the last moment to swing down the faceplate of her combat suit. Most of the Verdcris soldiers around her had boarded the dropship with their helmets already sealed up, but not all of them. The platoon leader and two of the Sergeants had their faceplates up, with only the bottom of the inner visor obscuring their eyes. Her delay in sealing the faceplate was not a show of confidence in the Ruhar, who were flying both the Dahl Ternodden and the dropship. It was to avoid the Verdcris around her thinking that she was disgusted by the way they smelled. The Kristang, including their Verd cousins, did have a scent like lizard skin warmed by the sun. The scent was not strong, it was not unpleasant, but it was different and distinctive. She had been told that humans were considered somewhat smelly by the Verds, which is why she used special scent masking soap and shampoo provided by UNEF. Crammed into the Dodo dropship with her were 40 Verdcris soldiers, a full platoon. The Verds organized their infantry units differently than standard UNEF practice. The lowest level unit was a squad, 8 soldiers led by a Sergeant 3rd class. 4 squads in an infantry platoon, plus a headquarters unit led by a Sergeant 2nd class and a Getran, the rough equivalent to a lieutenant. With 40 Verds in full combat armor, plus Danny, the dropship's cabin was full. Only one seat remained empty. Strapped to that one unoccupied seat were a crate of rifle ammunition and a crate of rockets, the platoon's soldiers having understood that no one ever regretted having too much ammo. The platoon leader checked in with each squad verbally over the command net, though he had access to status data from every armored suit in the platoon. When it came time for him to check on Danny, he leaned forward in his seat at the rear cabin and flashed a thumbs up at her.
"Squared away, Captain Grace?"
She appreciated that he had either learned the American expression or taken the time to program his suit's translator to use appropriate military slang.
"Squared away, Getran Zolotas," she replied, giving him a thumbs up in return.
She could have said lieutenant and trusted the translator to convert that word to the equivalent rank in the Verdcris military structure, but saying Getran was just as easy. Plus, the platoon leader would know what she said, because the translator always slightly altered the speaker's voice.
"This is your first combat drop?" Zolotas asked.
She had to think a moment. The platoon leader was being unusually chatty.
"I guess the landing on Fresno doesn't count. We weren't under fire then."
"I missed the operation on Fresnico," Zolotas said with regret. "This will be my first landing on a hostile world. Do you have any advice for me?"
Before answering, she checked her visor to assure they were speaking on a private channel. The reason the platoon leader was so chatty was simple, she realized. He was nervous. Danny had been assigned to that particular platoon because it was a reserve unit, not intended to engage in combat on the first day unless frontline units needed reinforcement. The Verds wanted to keep her safe if they could.
"The Coloras," she used the Verd slang term for Ruhar, "are doing all the flying. We are just passengers. There isn't much we can do until we get boots on the ground. My advice is, try not to puke in your helmet."
"Ha! Thank you, Captain."
Chapter 10. With 15 minutes remaining, Jesse ordered his squad to don their helmets, seal the faceplates, and breathe filtered cabin air. Everyone's suits were operating nominally according to the indicators in his visor. Heart rates were elevated, including his own. That was nothing to worry about. He had plenty of real issues to worry about, like the fact that his squad had never done a combat drop before. The pilots had run through the entire operation in both simulators and real spacecraft, and all his soldiers had to do was sit tight, hang on, and shut up until the Dodo's skids hit the ground. Hopefully the skids did not hit the ground. With that happy thought, He watched the countdown in the upper right of his visor. The assault carrier performed a jump to take the ship within 28 light seconds of the planet, getting close so the final jump into orbit would be so short that accuracy could be assured. "That was a solid jump," Irene Strebick announced from the cockpit. "We are waiting for the go signal from the command ship." Jesse knew the task force commander was waiting until all the assault carriers and support ships had jumped into position and reported their readiness. At that point, based on how many ships were expected to be available for the assault drop, the operation would be approved, delayed, or scratched. There was no reason to think they would not soon be racing down through the atmosphere. It had been a routine and relatively short jump, and they were still well beyond the effective range of the enemy's SD networks. An SD network that was supposed to have been destroyed anyway. "We are a go," Irene said, and Jesse saw heart rates spike briefly, including his own. When the clock on the display showed 7 minutes left, everyone aboard the Dodo went on internal oxygen and disconnected their suit power cells from the charging plates built into the CPACs. The display in his visor showed all suits had full supplies of oxygen and power. Across from him and toward the front of the cabin, Perkins leaned forward to look at him and offered a thumbs up. He gave her an empathetic double thumbs up and pushed himself back in the seat, feeling the straps automatically tugging tighter around him. The voice communications system was for official and essential use only, beginning half an hour before drop. But soldiers had discovered they could use the platoon status channel to send short text messages. Whispering into his helmet microphone, he recorded a message, checked it translated correctly to text, and sent it. The intended recipient was David Chaika. "Hey, Ski, don't do anything stupid," read the message. "Don't worry, Pwn, I won't do anything you would do," came the reply. "You watch out for my girl," Jesse sent. "You watch out for my girl," Dave sent. Then, "Best of luck, brother. See you dirt side." Jesse cut the link. The Ruhar crew were monitoring all electronic traffic, and he knew they would get annoyed if the conversation went on too long. To Shauna, he sent a simple emoji because she was busy with her own squad and received an emoji back. They had exchanged their goodbyes before assembling with their respective squads. Nothing more needed to be said. He was sure Dave was being similarly brief if he messaged Perkins, who was monitoring the ship's tactical channel and likely distracted. 5 minutes to jump. Aboard another dropship, located in a launch bay 80 meters aft of where Jesse waited, Dave closed out the message window and glanced across the cabin to Shauna. She didn't look at him, her eyes intent on the glowing icons splashed across her visor. He knew she was checking the life signs of the soldiers in her squad. To his right, Sergeant Jates sat impassively, and Dave could not see into the alien's helmet from where he was sitting. "Relax," Dave told himself. "This is just landing on another planet. You've done this before." "No," a little nagging voice in his head replied. "You have not done this before. The landings on Paradise, Fresno, and Jalaxico had been simple, with no opposition expected or encountered. Landing on Camp Alpha had been uneventful, only because the few lizards on that world had not detected the stealthy dropships coming down on the other side of the planet. An opposed spaceborne landing was new to him. It was a novel event for most of the Ruhar military also. The last time their fleet had supported an opposed landing was 38 Earth years ago. Usually, battles were won or lost in space before boots hit the ground. Over the long course of the war, both sides had slowly come to the realization that there was little to gain in holding on to a blockaded world. A fleet that controlled the skies could bombard the surface with conventional weapons, gradually reducing cities to rubble and degrading infrastructure to the point where forces on the ground were limited to isolated groups equipped only with rifles, afraid to poke their heads out from under the stealth netting that concealed their hiding places. If an opposed spaceborne landing was an unaccustomed event for the Ruhar, it was completely unknown to the humans, the Verdkris, and the Achakai in the landing force. Certainly, the ninja lizards had plenty of experience with stealthy infiltration, but operating as part of a large, organized force was outside their training. Whether the Achakai could effectively operate in groups of thousands or even hundreds was a very good question, What bothered Dave about the whole scheme was that he was risking his life for someone else's experiment. As he settled back in his seat and pressed the helmet against the bulkhead, Dave was glad he had visited the Dodo's tiny bathroom with plenty of time to spare. The Dodo's engines throttled up, testing the clamps that held the spacecraft in place, then went back to idle. 4 minutes remaining. Cadet Nert Danderf realized he was holding his breath in his seat at a console in the launch control center. The display was currently overlooking the bay where Dave and Shauna's dropship was resting on its launch rails. Quietly, he let out a breath, feeling silly, because no one could hear him inside his sealed-up helmet. He was wearing a shipboard environment suit instead of a combat skin suit, equipment designed to keep him breathing and useful if the ship lost air pressure, not intended for use in infantry fighting. To his left and right, the actual crew of the ship had their helmets attached to the back of their chairs with the faceplates open. Regulations stated they must have helmets within reach for the combat drop, and they trusted their helmets to slam the faceplates closed for them if needed. Until then, being able to speak the old-fashioned way was a useful backup in case of communications failure. Nert wished he could have left his faceplate retracted, or at least cracked open. His status as a cadet required him to be sealed up before the assault carrier had jumped into orbit. He also was not supposed to touch the console in front of him, though he was trained on the operation of all the consoles in the cramped alcove. He could monitor the displays, standing by in case one of the crew needed to be relieved, and to assist in damage control if needed. What he really wanted was to be on the assault carrier's bridge where the real action was taking place. As the captain was not allowing any such nonsense, no matter how well-connected Nert's family was, being in the launch bay control center was the best available option. Across the board, all dropships were showing blue, the status for fully operational. His human friends were as prepared as they could be, with the resources of a full battle group to support them. Closing his eyes, he said a quiet prayer for his friends. 3 minutes. On the Tig McDonough's bridge, the executive officer turned to the captain seated next to him.
"All stations report ready for jump,"
he announced, repeating information the captain had readily available to her on multiple displays scattered around the compartment. Reporting status was not necessary, bordering on silly. But it was his job right then, and damn it, he was going to do it. The captain acknowledged the announcement with a slight tilt of her head, not taking her eyes off the display to the side of her command station. "Navigator, predicted jump accuracy?" That information was also available on a display. She asked the question not because she needed the data, but because she wanted the jump navigation team to know she appreciated their efforts. At the level of technology available to the Ruhar, guiding a starship to arrive at a particular point in space was still partly an art that required experience, skill, and not a little bit of guesswork.
23 acrons, the navigator reported, speaking for her entire team.
The truth was she expected they would emerge within 18 acrons of the target coordinates. She added 5 acrons to pad the estimate. To give each assault carrier plenty of room to maneuver, and so their dropships did not interfere with each other, each carrier was assigned a bubble of space 250 acrons across. To reduce the distance the dropships needed to travel, the ships wanted to jump in at the edge of the atmosphere, an action that was tricky to accomplish so deep in a planet's gravity well. Too low, and the McDonough would have to claw its way up through atmospheric drag to jump distance. Too high, and the vulnerable dropships would have a longer, possibly fatal distance to reach the surface. 23. Captain Renal repeated without comment, mentally subtracting a couple acrons. The jump accuracy made little practical differences to the outcome of the operation, but it was a matter of pride between starship crews. Renal knew that each carrier ship would be watching the others and offering congratulations or insults after all ships had jumped away to safety. To her right, the executive officer bent to peer closely at the display in front of his chair.
"Decoy frigates are taking fire from the surface," he said with a frown.
Right on schedule, 8 Ruhar frigates had jumped into orbit above the landing zone, each ship launching a cloud of decoy drones before racing out to jump distance. The decoys were vital to the ability of the dropships to reach the surface. Even stealthed dropships would be detected once they began their searing flight through the atmosphere, leaving long, fiery pink trails of plasma behind them. The decoys would saturate the area with interference across the electromagnetic spectrum, vent superheated plasma, and create roiling contrails of disturbed air in their wake. For each dropship carrying soldiers to the surface, there would be at least 30 decoys, forcing the enemy defenses to fire multiple shots at any target. As soon as a missile battery, maser cannon, or railgun on the ground opened up, the Ruhar battleships in orbit would retaliate with a punishing barrage. "Enemy fire is categorized as random and light," Renault saw at a glance, just as Fleet Intelligence had predicted. After the sustained bombardment of targets on the surface, she was not surprised that the enemy had little left with which to hit back. She was surprised the Wirgalin were wasting their remaining heavy weapons on what they had to know were ships launching decoys. "Stupid of them," she observed, mostly to herself. The enemy knew an invasion was coming. They should have reserved their strike capabilities for the big assault carrier ships, not wasting fire on frigates. Maybe the Wirgalin were in such disarray that local commanders were shooting at any target of opportunity. A maser cannon might have a chance to cause damage to a frigate, while even the most stupid of the enemy must know the well-protected battleships were not worth trying to hit. Preparing for the jump that was now only 19 azels away, she rested her hands in her lap to prevent herself from accidentally touching any of the controls during the maneuver. The ship's executive officer did the same as they listened to the navigator counting down the jump. Renault was excited to be part of the first opposed spaceborne landing during her time in the service, and she was confident in her crew, her ship, and the battle fleet that surrounded the planet. There was only one worry nagging at the back of her mind. Her concern was not about the humans who would be flying some of the dropships and doing the fighting on the ground. The pilots appeared to be competent enough to be entrusted with the spacecraft they had been given, though she wasn't confident that many of those landing craft would return to their mother ship. Her responsibility for the landing force ended when the last dropship launched and cleared the McDonough's proximity defense perimeter, and she did not know much about ground combat. The idea of the ground action being split between humans, Verdkris, and the Ochakai sounded like a recipe for disaster. But that also was not her responsibility. Her concern was simple. The enemy was being unforgivably stupid by wasting their remaining heavy weapons on mere frigates. Why? It made no sense. Unless.
Do? The navigator read off the numbers. One. Jump.
The Tig McDonough emerged from twisted space-time in a brief, hellish flare of gamma radiation that raced ahead of the ship at the speed of light, leaving the outer layer of the ship's hull bathed in short-lived exotic particles. Sensors that had been turned off for protection during transition through the jump wormhole were energized again and began seeking to determine where the ship was and what was in the immediate area. Space around the ship was clear, other than debris from the space battle that had prepared the way for the assault. Based on sighting stars and the guide beacons projected by the battleships overhead, the McDonough was right where the ship should be, within 17 acrons. It was a good sign that the minor inaccuracy of the jump into orbit had placed the assault carrier slightly closer to the planet, leaving a shorter distance for the vulnerable dropships to fly. Technically, the McDonough was not in orbit, because it was already in the thin air of the planet's mesosphere, and moving slower than the speed needed to stay in orbit at that altitude. The ship's leading edges glowed with ionization as thin air struck at hypersonic speed, and the crew at the helm anxiously watched their altitude degrade as the atmospheric drag slowed the ship, dragging them down toward the surface. Every member of the McDonough's crew wished the dropships would all launch as quickly as possible so their bulky ship could accelerate and begin the climb out of the planet's gravity well up to jump altitude. "We're clear," the executive officer reported after taking an extra second to double-check the incoming sensor data. In addition to data collected by the ship's own resetting sensors, there was a feed from the battleships above. "Decoy batteries, commence launch," the captain ordered automatically, her attention also on the sensors. If the enemy had any surprises waiting for the task force, this was when they would be revealed. The ship shuddered as clouds of decoys were ejected from the ship. Some of the decoys turned to race down toward the planet. Others formed a bubble around the ship and began blasting the area with broad-spectrum jamming to blind enemy sensors. The larger decoys hit the upper atmosphere and ejected small submunitions, just like a dropship would. To the enemy on the ground, those decoys would look exactly like a dropship.
First volley of decoys away. Batteries are reloading, the second-in-command said. One portside battery is jammed. Engineering team is working on it.
Very well. Reynolds saw the incident on her own display.
Launch dropships. First away were the gunships, spat out of their bays along launcher rails on the side of the ship facing away from the planet. The energy shields on that side of the ship blinked to a lower intensity setting as the gunships went through. Their own shields turned to avoid interference with the assault carrier's protective blanket of energy. The gunships formed up in groups of four, leading the way at a casual pace as they waited for the troop carriers to join them. If all the dropships on one side of the ship launched at once, the kinetic energy would push the assault carrier sideways and possibly induce a spin. Instead, the launch proceeded nose to tail, with the forward launchers sending their cargo down the rails first. In the bridge compartment deep within the ship's stout frames, Captain Renault's attention was drawn to the main display. A maser cannon on the surface had just fired at the assault carrier Dahl Ternadin, orbiting on the same track ahead of the McDonough.
Ternadin is undamaged, a sensor officer reported. Battleships are returning fire.
A muted cheer rang around the bridge as the crew saw a flare on the surface. The enemy maser cannon ceased firing. A railgun round from the surface struck the Ternadin, and the ship staggered, temporarily halting its launches. Renault shared a glance with her exec. Neither of them were overly concerned. The Ternadin was taking a pounding, and that made sense. The enemy would want their limited resources focused on a single target to maximize the chance of scoring a hit. Bad luck for the Ternadin was good luck for the other assault carriers. Of the eight assault carriers in a rough diamond formation, only one was taking fire. Renault felt certain that happy circumstance would change when the dropships bored their way lower in the atmosphere, where they would be vulnerable to portable anti-aircraft maser cannons and shoulder-launched missiles that the preparatory bombardment had not suppressed. To survive flying down through the expected barrage, the dropships would have to trust their stealth capabilities, energy shields, point defense cannon, and most importantly, the clouds of decoys that would divert the enemy's attention. Not all the decoys were mere targets. Some of them contained submunitions designed to seek and destroy anti-aircraft weapons. Any Wargalan on the ground who dared fire a portable missile had to discard the empty launch tube and run as fast as their multiple legs could carry them, for they would become a target as soon as the missile's exhaust plume was detected. Wherever that enemy railgun was on the surface, that area was under cloud cover, because the retaliatory strike by the battleships was visible only on infrared as a red plume that slowly spread out. Either the battleships had little else to do, or the task force commander was seriously annoyed at the enemy's failure to acknowledge they were beaten, because the infrared plume was followed by five others, saturating the target area. That railgun did not fire again, nor was the Ternadin hit by another maser cannon. Despite several shield generators that were knocked back to 70% power, the assault carrier declared it was still combat effective. The crew rolled their ship so the weakened shields faced away from the planet and resumed launching dropships. Renault considered the McDonough's sister ship with admiration. Leaning toward her XO, she whispered just loud enough for the bridge crew to hear.
If that's the best they've got to throw at us,
we can handle this. The XO mused hopefully. First time Fleet Intelligence has been correct about anything. I'll buy them a drink if...
The image of the Dahl Ternadin was replaced by a flare of orange light as that ship's shields deflected terawatts of directed energy. When the photons of the blast washed over the McDonough, the stunned bridge crew could see the other assault carrier tilted at a right angle to its flight path and tumbling. Pieces broke away as the damaged ship was struck again. Renault instinctively tried to rise from her chair, restrained by the straps.
That fire came from above, she gasped.
The enemy strategic defense network apparently had not been completely neutralized.
Someone made a mistake!
A third searing bolt of X-ray laser energy struck the Ternadin, Defense shields flickered and blinked out as their generators were overwhelmed. The beam sliced into the hull, blasting armor plating apart like tissue paper and melting structural frames in the heart of the ship. Its spine broken, the assault carrier sagged in the middle, nose and tail bending slowly in opposite directions. Then the Ternadin broke in half, the shattered ends glowing with harsh arcs of lightning as power conduits released their energy into the void.
"Someone made a big goddamn mistake," Captain Renal barked. "Helm, break for high orbit. Get us to jump distance."
Thrusters under the Tig McDonough's nose fired to point the ship away from the planet and the shattered remains of the Dahl Ternadin, while the assault carrier's main engines spun up to full emergency thrust. The big engines were slow to ramp up, and the acceleration built up almost imperceptibly. In the dropships that had not yet launched, pilots saw with alarm their mother ship's new course, clawing for jump altitude. Their orders had not changed. The assault carrier was still spitting out dropships one at a time, each launch accompanied by clusters of sensor-jamming decoys. On the tactical data feed, all the pilots had seen what happened to the Dahl Ternadin, and every single one of them was eager to get the hell away from the carrier as fast as possible. Ordinarily, dropships were safer while wrapped inside the carrier's powerful energy shields and protected by the big ship's proximity defense cannons. Also, ordinarily, an assault carrier would not be flying low and slow in an area covered by active enemy SD platforms. No way would the Wargalan waste an SD platform on a single dropship. But an assault carrier was a big fat target, and clearly, whatever weapons the enemy still had were capable of slicing through a warship's shields. Regardless of the understandable anxiety of the pilots, they had to wait while their mothership rotated around its long axis and it was their turn to launch. Quietly and not so quietly, the pilots of dropships toward the back of the line urged the ships at the front of the line to move and get on with it. The anger was misdirected, for the entire process was automated, and there wasn't anything the pilots could do, and that made no difference. Bitching about a problem they couldn't affect was still doing something. Whether the human dropship pilots trusted the assault ship's Ruhar crew or not didn't matter. They knew the crew wanted the dropships all away ASAP to lighten the carrier's mass so they could reach jump altitude faster. Getting to a higher altitude, where the starship's jump drive could rip a hole in space-time and create a temporary wormhole, was not a matter of going up, but of going forward and faster. All eight of the assault carriers had jumped in carrying momentum that yielded a speed below that required to keep the ships from falling out of orbit at that altitude. That was a risky plan, a maneuver intended to shorten the time their vulnerable dropships were exposed to enemy fire from the ground, and a plan approved only in the absence of a threat from strategic defense satellites, or what the task force commander thought was the absence of any enemy SD network. The McDonough needed to increase speed to achieve a stable orbit, then escape velocity, then rocket away past an imaginary line where the planet's gravity well was weak enough to allow the formation of a jump wormhole that would bring the assault carrier somewhere, anywhere, other than under the deadly guns of the enemy SD network. The McDonough's engines reached full military thrust. Then the engineers authorized releasing safety mechanisms until the mighty engines were vibrating on their magnetic mounts at 7% more than their rated power. The engineers knew that later they would need to tear down the engines one at a time for inspection and repairs, and that process would be an enormous pain in the ass. But all they cared about was that there would be a later for them, which would not happen if a strategic defense satellite got the McDonough in its sights. 3.15 light seconds above the formation of assault carriers, that now consisted of seven intact starships and one broken hull, a stealth strategic defense satellite clutched a spinning gyroscope inside its shell, an action that caused the barrel of its cannon to pivot toward a new target. The doomed ship below it was accelerating, but had not yet reached a velocity where its orbit was stable, and it was so low that its belly scraped the wispy top of the planet's atmosphere. Without any anger or fear, the satellite accepted its tasking from the stealthy network control satellite, joining two other satellites and targeting that single ship. One satellite could cause damage to the well-protected enemy ship. Two satellites had a better-than-even chance of disabling the target. Three satellites guaranteed a hard kill. At the satellite's heart was not any advanced technology, such as an atomic compression device, because such tech was far beyond the capabilities of the Wargalan. The machine that would power the satellite's laser cannon was merely a crude boosted fission bomb. The nuclear weapon did not need to be lightweight. It did not need to be small. It only needed to generate energy to power an X-ray laser that would be vaporized during its one-time use. If the satellite's tiny brain had been capable of thought, it might have desired to die while taking out one of the enemy battleships that had devastated most of the planet's defenses. Those battleships had pounded targets on the surface and cleared the skies, but had failed to search more than 2 light seconds from the planet. Knocking a battleship out of action would be a comfort in the satellite's suicidal explosion, but even the limited computer understood that while battleships could rule the skies, they could not take and hold the planet. The troops brought by the assault carriers posed the true threat, and while a carrier was a lesser target, the satellite understood the logic of the network controller. Although the network controller AI was widely acknowledged to be an insufferably arrogant asshole, if all the SD satellites fervently hoped their own deaths would result in the enemy battleships hunting down and destroying the network control AI, that too was understandable. At a signal from the network controller, the strategic defense satellite sent an electric pulse along a channel, branching off to a series of conduits connected to conventional explosive plates wrapped around the plutonium core of the weapon. Compressed by the explosives, the atoms of plutonium were crushed together into such a small space, they achieved critical mass and detonated outward, generating powerful X-rays that were collected by the lasing effect of the cannon barrel during the nanoseconds before it was consumed. Now, a focused beam of coherent photons, the X-rays stabbed out toward their target. When the X-rays struck the shields along the topside of the TIG McDonough, the intense photons were deflected outward, spread out along the outline of the shields around the top and both sides of the ship, or partially absorbed by the generators. Circuits in those generators overloaded and tripped off, protecting the generators but weakening the ship's defenses. Irene's palms had become sweaty in her flight suit gloves, damp enough that the gloves could not wick away the moisture, damp enough that she felt a hot trickle of water run down her wrist when she reached up one hand to touch a button on the ceiling of the cockpit. Her Dodo was third in line from the forward position, with the dropship carrying Chaika, Jarrett, and Jates fifth in line. Problem was, the assault carrier had not yet rotated, so that line was launching. 7 dropships remained in the current row of active launchers. With 24 seconds between launches to assure dropships did not collide, it would take nearly 3 minutes for the current row to complete launching. Then the ship needed 64 seconds to rotate the next row into position. Add time to launch the 2 spacecraft in line ahead of her, and she was looking at a wait of almost 5 freaking minutes before her Dodo was hurled down the rails into space. The purpose of a controlled, measured launch procedure was so dropships remained inside the protection of the warship's shields as long as possible. That was a sensible precaution when the chief threat was anti-aircraft artillery and small missiles. With a fully active SD network shooting at the assault transports, Irene reflected that the freaking hamsters seriously needed to rethink their approach to opposed spaceborne landings. "Eject the damn dropships all at once," she silently suggested, "and trust overwhelming numbers and decoys to get the dropship's dirt side safely." "The next time we do something like this," she said quietly to Derek, "I have some helpful hints for the hamsters." Derek reached over and patted the other pilot's hand. "I am sure you will phrase your hints in a calm and constructive manner and drop them in a suggestion box. I would like to write them on my boot and put it up the ass of whatever idiot dreamed up the op plan for this landing." "Uh-huh. Like I said, calm and constructive." He nodded knowingly. "Do you think we should trust this task force?" she demanded. "The hamsters missed a whole damned SD network out there." "They missed 2 or 3 satellites, he spoke gently. It did no good to get Irene riled up. "That's all we know. We did expect some losses on this." The Dodo rocked, and not by itself. The entire ship shuddered. Derek held the sides of the console as the ship shook, careful not to touch any of the controls. "What the hell was—" "Strebik," Perkins called from the cabin. "What the hell was that?" With one eye on the tactical display, Irene answered.
Your guess is as good as mine, ma'am.
In her tone was a note of mild irritation, maybe even reproach. The Maverick's commanding officer had access to a higher level of intel than was available to the pilots. Perkins got the message. Trouble was, the command data feed from the Big Mac was offline. She wasn't receiving anything at all. Switching to the ship's status network, she immediately realized the incident was no mere glitch with the launcher. The ship had been hit, and hit hard. Orange and red icons were lit up all over the schematic of the ship in her visor. Shields along the ship's ventral spine were at 60% strength or lower. Multiple shield generators were offline, in the process of resetting. Emily Perkins thought it unlikely the enemy would give the Big Mac time to bring its defenses back to full strength.
Strebik, launch us now. I'm sending a general evac signal to all dropships. Watch out for traffic out there.
Though Captain Renault controlled the operation of her ship, Perkins was in command of the landing force aboard the McDonough, including the dropships. Technically, an order to accelerate the planned launch sequence required permission from the ship's captain, but communications were down, and besides, well, screw that. Perkins would act first and request permission later, if she lived that long.
Ma'am? Irene's eyes widened in shock. We can't launch on our own. The sequence is automated.
The sequence has us sitting here like fish in a barrel for another, Perkins checked her visor.
4 minutes. The Big Mac won't hold together that long. This is on my authority. Launch now. That's an order.
Neither Irene nor Derek needed to see the orders engraved on official Legion stationery. They felt the ship continuing to vibrate as thrusters fired to stabilize its flight path. Loosening the straps that held him, Derek awkwardly bent down between their seats, unlocking a panel in the floor. Underneath was a yellow lever, printed with bold warnings in Ruhar script.
Ready when you are, babe, he said softly.
There was the briefest hesitation before Irene reached forward to activate her console. The regs said she wasn't supposed to authorize the flight controls until the launch rails began to energize.
Let's see if this works, or if the hamsters were lying to us.
Again, she added for emphasis, knowing the flight recorder was capturing everything she said and did. What they were doing violated safety regulations, and she and Derek would get in trouble if they survived. Between death and getting yelled at by hamsters, she was okay with the yelling.
Hold for my signal, she told Derek. I want to get some forward momentum going before you release from the launch rails.
Got it, he grunted. The position bent sideways between the seats was awkward in the flight suit. It made sense to get the big dodo moving in the right direction before releasing the clamps that held the spacecraft to the launch rail, otherwise they could bounce off the launch bay and break something important. Irene had the main engines on standby, being careful not to touch those controls. Those engines were too powerful to use in the launch bay, especially in rocket mode where they weren't gulping oxygen from outside. Instead, she started the thruster pumps, building up pressure, and a warning light flashed, locking her out. On the display, a message in Ruhar script scolded her for attempting to do something dangerous and foolish and, damn it! She toggled off the alarm and warning message. Derek tried to look up, but at the angle he couldn't see Irene's face.
What? Freaking thing locked me out. Let's see if this override works as advertised.
Ruhar spacecraft were equipped with artificial intelligence computers that, while blessedly lacking the self-awareness that could be annoying, could interfere with the pilot's operation. That fact had been declared unacceptable by the community of Ruhar pilots, so there was a workaround that could force the computer to do whatever the pilot thought necessary, regardless of the AI's judgment. In training, Irene and Derek had been shown how to bypass the automated controls, and the process appeared to be straightforward. What scared her were rumors that Ruhar systems had failed to disengage for human pilots. If the hamsters distrusted how primitive humans would fly their expensive spacecraft, the overrides might have been disabled. Everything worked just like it had during emergency procedures during training, except at the last stage, the AI did not acknowledge the override.
Oh, you son of a—
Strebik,
Bonsu, what is the problem? Why aren't we moving? Perkins demanded.
Working on it, ma'am, Derek answered for his co-pilot.
This stupid thing!
Irene paused in mid-rant. The display was now showing manual access enabled in English. When the system had not instantly granted access, she assumed it was refusing to comply when it really had just been going through the proper steps to enable manual control. Maybe she should not be so impatient.
We're good.
Inching up the aft thruster power, she felt the spacecraft trembling as the thrust pushed against the clamps holding the Dodo to the launch rails.
Okay. Release!
The ship rocked again, hard. Irene's seat jerked to the left, then up, and her hands bounced off the controls. Lights in the cockpit did not even flicker, but the string of white lamps illuminating the launch bay blinked out, as did all external power sources. The ship had been hit again. Artificial gravity flickered in waves that made Irene's stomach do flip-flops, then gravity cut off entirely.
Derek!
She shouted, wrapping her pinky fingers around the sides of the console to stabilize her hands.
We are out of here! Brace for—
No good, he grunted, straining at the release handle.
It's stuck, I think.
Sitting upright and stretching to see over the wraparound displays, he studied the launch bay, even as the ship continued to shake violently.
The launch rails are bent. The clamps must be stuck. Shit!
She could see the doors at the far end of the bay were cracked open, allowing a thin sliver of blindingly harsh sunlight through. The doors weren't just cracked open, they were cracked. The ship's structure had flexed so much the frame was warped and bent the doors with it.
Oh, that's bad, Derek gasped.
His fingers flew over the controls, jabbing a button once, twice, three times. The sliver of light grew marginally thicker.
The doors are jammed. We'll never get out of here. I can't raise anyone on comms.
Irene pounded a fist on her thigh. The doors had both a manual release mechanism and explosive bolts that could blow the doors outward in an emergency. Neither of those options were available to the pilots. Or maybe the Ruhar had just not trusted humans with anything that affected the assault carrier's operations. The ship heaved again, and Irene's chin bashed against the helmet liner, making her bite her lower lip. She tasted blood and ignored it.
Irene, Derek,
Perkins barked, using the pilot's first names for emphasis.
Whatever you gotta do, do it now.
Screw this. Derek slapped the access panel closed, not wasting any more time trying to get the clamps released.
Rip her loose.
What? Irene gaped at the other pilot.
Pop the belly thrusters. They'll break the clamps free.
That will also prang the tail assembly, she protested. And if the clamps don't tear away cleanly, we won't be able to close the gear doors.
You want to stay here?
Derek asked, concentrating on his own task.
Hell no.
Shit!
She gestured toward the jammed doors.
We can't get out anyway.
Derek's response was to link the maser cannon under the Dodo's chin to the heads-up display in his helmet visor and energize the weapon. Pulses of coherent microwave radiation stabbed out to strike the inner surface of the launch bay doors, starting on the lower right corner.
Those doors are armored, she warned.
Armor plating is on the outside, he explained. We don't need to cut through the armor, just the doors.
She could see he was right. His aim was jittery as the ship was shaking, so the section cut by the maser cannon wavered in a sloppy, jagged line of burnt composites and melted alloys.
Cannon is overheating, she noted. I'm cutting out the safeties.
Derek didn't reply. He had the right-hand door almost loose. It was bending as the maser cut across the top. With a screeching groan that was audible through the Dodo structure, the right-hand door popped off its track and sprang outward, tumbling end over end before it quickly disappeared. Freed from the locking mechanism, the left side of the door slid jerkily aside until it jammed again.
Go, 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 go!
Popping the belly thrusters for a tenth of a second burst only made red warning lights flash on both pilot consoles. Programming a quarter-second burst, she hit the activate button. The Dodo broke loose and banged against the ceiling of the launch bay with a crack that shook loose dust from panels inside the cockpit.
There goes the tail,
Irene gritted her teeth.
Hang on,
she advised grimly. The Dodo bounced and scraped its way along the launch bay. Both pilots did their best to keep their craft in the center of the bay, and the damage incurred was not due to the lack of skill,
The ship was heaving and rocking and spinning as they tried to fly the short distance to get clear of the assault carrier.
Are you going to... Whoa!
Derek flinched instinctively as something big and dark spun past the doors outside. They might escape from the ship only to smack into flying debris.
Watch out for...
I see it! Irene snapped in a way that meant shut the hell up. The Dodo's wings were retracted into their slots under the fuselage, reducing the spacecraft's cross-section so it could fit in the launch bay. The jammed left-hand door still left the opening too small for the dropship to fit through with a comfortable clearance because of sponsons that bulged out from the lower sides of the Dodo's center section. Irene had to guess at the best angle to thread her ship through the opening, an angle that constantly changed as the starship shook around them. A horrible hair-raising bang,
screech,
as they flew through the jagged opening told her they had hit something against something, and there were so many warning lights flashing red and orange that all she could do was to fly the damned thing and worry about what had gotten busted later. If there was a later. That the tail of the Dodo had not already been sheared off became evident when there was another shriek of protesting composites from the rear of the spacecraft and the nose lurched up out of control, thrusters popping as the tail assembly tore away.
We're clear! Get the...
The Big Mac erupted in flame, and something slammed into the Dodo from behind. Chapter 11 Danny Grace snacked her forehead into the cushions at the front of her helmet as the dropship lurched hard, the nose dipping, then pivoting up. If the helmet had not been tethered to the seat she was strapped into, the jolt would have been worse. She winced and blinked, her vision blurry, grateful that the smart helmet had automatically inflated the cushions to protect her.
What is...
she began to ask when the communications network cut off her transmit access. The pilots of the dropship and leaders of the platoon did not need people distracting them with random and stupid questions. Tasting blood from having bit her lip somehow, she eye-clicked to a view from the dropship's external sensors and gasped. The ship they had launched from moments before, the massive assault carrier Dahl Ternadin, was cracking in half, the hull barely visible through intense flares of light. During the 2 or 3 seconds she watched in horror, the carrier twisted and tore itself apart, stout composite frames splintering and breaking away, arcs of electricity searing space around the ship. As the two pieces separated completely, a thick bolt of lightning sparked between the hull sections, sending tendrils of light out toward... The dropship shuddered, and sparks burst out of the cabin wall opposite Danny, charring the suits of the two soldiers seated there. She had no time to scream before intense sunlight flared through multiple pinpoint holes in her side of the cabin, high-speed debris tearing through the dropship's hull like tissue paper. 5 soldiers on the other side of the cabin were splattered by debris like shotgun pellets, their armor suits shredded. Air shrieked out holes in both sides of the cabin, blood seeping in zero gravity being pulled through the holes along with the air that had filled the cabin. Without her doing anything, her own armored suit flashed a notice that it had switched to internal air supply, and she took a panicked gulp of air into her lungs. The dropship was tumbling and vibrating, beams of sunlight coming through pinprick holes in the hull looking like laser beams shining through dust, blood, and flash-frozen water vapor that had been in the cabin before it was punctured. The beams danced erratically as the ship shuddered, automatic systems and the pilots trying to stabilize the spacecraft's tumble before they fell deeper into atmosphere.
Think, Danny, she shouted to herself.
Whatever the pilots were doing or not doing, she couldn't affect the dropship's chances of survival, nor could she survive bailing out at that altitude. The emergency parachute on her back wasn't designed for jumping from orbit. By the time she fell deep enough in the air for the chute to be useful, she would be moving so fast the chute material would be shredded. At least, that is what the Ruhar instructors had told her during training. Stay aboard the dropship and trust the alien spacecraft's stealth, energy shields, defensive maser cannons, and decoy drones to get her to the ground safely. The real danger would come once her boots hit the ground, the Ruhar had told her.
Liars!
The ship that had brought her there, a massive assault carrier, had been cut in half by enemy fire, despite the assurances of the Ruhar that enemy defenses had been thoroughly suppressed by the orbital bombardment. What else had the hamsters been wrong about? Her brain and her icy stomach were both telling her the same thing. Get out of here, now. Before she realized what she was doing,
Her hands were on the manual latch to release the straps holding her to the seat. She stared down at her hands, wondering what they were doing, when any thought of bailing out and hoping a search and rescue ship would pick her up in orbit vanished. A chunk of something tore through the cabin at a diagonal, leaving a small hole forward on her side and a big hole in the abdomen of the soldiers seated beside the platoon leader at the rear of the cabin. Blood exploded outward, splattering the platoon leader as the flash-frozen droplets floated away, performing a macabre dance in the zero gravity. Danny didn't scream. She just blinked, once, slowly. The soldier who had just died didn't have a chance to survive. She did. The platoon leader tore open a bandage packet and applied it to the soldier who had been killed, moving with quiet calm. The square bandage rippled outward, seeking to cover the maximum volume, thinning as it stretched out. Seeing the platoon leader continuing to do his job, even if all he accomplished was stemming the flow of blood into the chaos of the dropship's cabin, made something click in her mind. "Do your job," she reminded herself, and focused on the status icons and the visor of her own helmet. To her surprise, a yellow light softly blinking on an outline of her suit showed that she too had been struck by debris. Until the suit informed her of the minor damage, she had not noticed a hot liquid sensation on the outside of her upper left arm. Instinct told her to do what she could to help the stricken soldiers on the opposite side of the cabin. Training and a bit of common sense reminded her what she should do. Check herself first, then try to help others. Reaching over with her right hand, her gloved fingers felt a jagged crease in the armor covering her left arm, and her fingers came away with a coating of gray dust mixed with blood. Her blood. The visor was flashing a warning not to interfere with the suit's process of repairing itself. Relying on training rather than instinct, she laid her fingers close to the rent in the armor, trusting the gray nanoparticle goo to slide off her gloves and back into the suit where it could work on repairing the tear. As she looked down, she saw blood smeared across the front of her armor. It couldn't be her blood unless... With a start, she realized the soldier to her right had droplets of blood slowly seeping from a series of pinhole punctures in the front of his armor. She eye-clicked through a menu in her visor until the platoon channel came up, informing her that the Verd Chris next to her was deceased. Shit. Holy shit. Her hands shook as she turned to look at the wall of the cabin between her and the dead man. It was peppered with fine holes, an inch or two closer to her, and she would be.
Grace! Captain Grace! The guttural tone of a lizard spoke to her.
Yes. In her visor, she could see the call was coming from platoon leader Zolotus. Sometimes it was difficult to tell Verdcris voices apart after they were translated.
The pilots told me we need to plug the holes in the cabin before we hit the atmosphere.
Before we... She paused, comprehending the words.
We're going in?
Looking at the platoon status in her visor, she counted 13 dead and 6 seriously injured. That the 6 wounded had survived was a minor miracle. Being struck by debris in space was usually fatal.
The platoon is still combat effective, the leader insisted.
But we...
If the rest of this op is as fucked up as it started, the Verd Chris growled, we need all the boots we can get on the ground. The pilots tell me it's too kinetic to stay up here.
Hearing that, Danny briefly wondered whether the Verd had picked up U.S. military slang or the translator had done that for him.
We don't have a choice anyway. Both engines are damaged. We can't reach a stable orbit from here. We are following the battalion down as best we can. The other dropships and decoys will provide cover for us.
She knew the Verd was explaining more details than she needed to hear, both because she was human and because she outranked him in the Legion hierarchy. Her rank did not mean she should or could interfere with Zolotus's command of the platoon.
Understood. Can you patch the holes in your area? The kits are...
I know where the patch kits are. She reached down under her seat and felt the metal tube. It contained a sticky spray that would flow into gaps and harden like iron. She had seen its use in training. The dropship lurched again as she held the can in both hands, pointing the nozzle toward the cabin wall to her right.
I am trusting my life to a can of Fix-A-Flat, she told herself. Next time I am keeping my ass on the ground.
The other dodo assigned to the Mavericks aboard the Tig McDonough experienced the same situation as the dropship flown by Irene and Derek, with one major and fatal difference. The pilots of the craft were Ruhar instead of human. When the Big Mac was hit the first time, everyone looked to Lieutenant Gao, seated in the rear of the cabin. It wasn't known what conversation he exchanged with the pilots because he used the command channel, but the discussion must have been brief.
"The ship is undamaged," Gao told the troops in the cabin. "Shields are holding. We launch in 5 minutes. This was not unexpected," Gao added in what was not exactly a lie.
Some sort of problem during the landing operation was expected. Discovering the enemy had a second layer of strategic defense was not. The message Emily Perkins sent to accelerate the launching was not heard by Gao or any human in the dropship, and if the Ruhar pilots heard the message, they ignored it. Doctrine stated the safest place for vulnerable aerospace craft was inside the shields and armor of an assault carrier, not exposed in space where directed energy beams and high-speed debris was flying around. The dropship, which the pilots properly called a Lotentix instead of the insulting human term Dodo, was under Ruhar control, and no human could give orders to the crew of the Tig McDonough. When the ship was hit the second time, hit hard enough that one of the pilots spoke on the common channel to assure the human passengers that everything was normal and they would be launching soon, Shauna had enough.
"This is bullshit," she announced to Dave and Jates, taking a deep breath to calm the butterflies in her stomach as the ship's artificial gravity cut off.
She did not try talking with the lieutenant, because Gao's head was bobbing back and forth, and he was gesturing with his hands. She guessed that their lieutenant was having a discussion with the pilots, and it did not look like the pilots were politely inviting Gao to the cockpit for tea and crumpets.
"I agree the situation is less than optimal," Jade said, speaking English on his own rather than through a translator.
The Sergin had worked tirelessly to learn English first, as it was the common language of the American and British contingents of the Legion.
"What do you propose we do about it?"
"I don't know." Shauna threw up her hands. "Something. Anything other than waiting here for the next SD platform to target us." "We don't know if the ship is hit bad or just a local note is out," Dave suggested, not believing one word of what he said. "The hamster battleships have got to be hitting back. There might not be another satellite left out there to hit us."
"Yeah," Shauna snorted.
"You want to bet your life on that?"
"No," Dave admitted.
"I'm open to suggestions," he added with a look toward the cockpit door. It could be locked from the inside, and even if he was considering mutiny, no one in the Dodo's cabin was qualified to fly the damned thing.
"LT?" Shauna asked.
"Lieutenant Gao?" "One moment, Staff Sergeant," Gao snapped, irritated.
After a pause and a disgusted jerk of his head, he turned his attention to her, speaking on the channel with Shauna, Dave, Jates, and the two fireteam sergeants.
"The pilots say there's nothing they can do. One of them wants to launch now, but the outer doors are controlled by the ship and they can't contact anyone outside."
"Shit," Dave spat.
"So we're stuck here?"
"No, Mr. Chaika," Gao replied in a chiding tone.
"The launch rails are still energized. There's no reason to think we won't launch on schedule. We are safer here than anywhere else aboard the ship, and we can't launch before the schedule rolls around to—"
Gao never finished what he was going to say.
"Get me comms, dammit,"
General Ross demanded from his seat just behind the cockpit bulkhead of his dodo. The dropship carrying him and his small command staff had launched safely from the assault carrier Earl Mechadon, known to the humans aboard as the Old MacDonald. A Ruhar technician looked up from his console with a pained expression.
"General, we are working on—"
"We have all this fancy shit you're so proud of."
Ross jabbed a finger at the pile of gear that occupied the back half of the Dodo's cabin, taking up valuable space that could have been used for soldiers and weapons. By directly criticizing the Ruhar operating the communications equipment and, by inference, technology behind the alien gear, he was breaking UNEF protocol.
"Screw protocol."
The hamster fleet had breezily declared that air and space defenses had been quickly and thoroughly suppressed by the preparatory bombardment from orbit. The speed with which the task force commander cleared the assault carriers to move in had generated surprise and concern not only among the humans, Verdkris and Achakai, who would be dropping to the planet's surface. There was also grumbling by the Ruhar liaison officers who worked closely with the three groups of aliens. Officially, all of the Ruhar expressed confidence in the task force ships and crews. Unofficially, some of the intel people worried that the commander might have underestimated the Wargalan. It was true that the Wargalan military was historically weaker than the Krestang, who were the Ruhar fleet's usual opponents. It was true that the Wargalan were noticeably lower on the technology ladder than the Krestang. It was also true that the Ruhar had not fought a major engagement against the Wargalan in over 70 years. The Torgala had provided high-level data about the weapons and tactics of the Wargalan, but the Torgs had not sent a recon ship to Stiglord in over a decade, so the task force had gone in without the advantage of the best information available. When the cruisers and destroyers of the task force chased away the enemy fleet and the big guns of the battleships cleared space around the planet by blasting the local strategic defense network to dust, confidence had soared. There was even talk about the possibility of pulling the battleships out early and accelerating the overall schedule. Then, an entire unknown second layer of SD satellites had opened up on the assault carriers with powerful X-ray lasers, and the operation went to shit in a flash of coherent photons.
"Sir,"
the Ruhar technician pressed his eyes closed tightly, in a gesture that Ross interpreted to mean the hamster was trying to be patient with the primitive human. That got Ross pissed off.
"Damn it, get this gear working! I know you're not supposed to deploy the antenna yet, and I don't give a shit about that. We are carrying 3 spares. Get the damn thing reeled out behind us, or I'll find someone who knows what the hell they're doing."
The Ruhar technician was stung by the public criticism, and Ross didn't give a shit about that either. When the Dahl Ternadin had been cut in half with 40% of that carrier's dropships still in their launch bays, his ability to give a shit about problems of the Ruhar fleet had run out. Without further comment or protest, the Ruhar began letting the long, whip-like antenna unreel behind the dropship. The electromagnetic energy devoted to jamming communications in the battle space around the planet rivaled the energy of the weapons flying from both sides, with the result that neither side could maintain command and control without relying on line-of-sight laser links, and even those were spotty. Only the big starships and specialized spacecraft like the one carrying Ross's UNEF command staff had the equipment to cut through jamming. "The Big Mac has been hit again," one of the human pilots called out through the open door. The fancy comm gear required Ruhar specialists to operate it, but Ross had insisted that humans fly the Dodo.
"They're losing power."
Ross clenched his fists, putting the energy of his frustration into those muscles instead of into more angry words. The antenna was being set up. There wasn't anything he could do to speed the process along. They would lose that antenna when the dropship hit the atmosphere. It would need to be cut to avoid the line becoming fouled around the descending spacecraft's tail. Those minutes when he would lose communications were unavoidable anyway. The heat of hitting the air at suborbital speed would envelop the Dodo in a shroud of plasma that even the special antenna could not cut through. Loss of the Dahl Ternadin, and likely up to 40% of the dropships aboard that carrier, was a heavy blow. But losing the Big Mac would be worse, for half of the human force had been crammed into that one ship. Dividing the Legion along lines determined by a species made for simpler logistics, transport, and communications, and Ross understood the logic behind that decision. Now the result was that he might lose half of the force he commanded even before they hit atmosphere.
"General," the Ruhar technician announced stiffly, without taking his eyes off the console to look at the human officer. "The antenna is now functional."
"Outstanding," Ross muttered under his breath, belatedly hoping the hamster did not catch the sarcasm in his tone. He had a sensor feed from the fleet, probably a link to one of the battleships in higher orbit. The first item he saw was that the Dahl Ternadin was in 2 major and countless smaller pieces, yet as he watched, a dropship launched from the spinning forward section. That assault carrier had a contingent of Verdkris, so good for them. As Ross did not command the Verd part of the Legion, and he couldn't do anything about the fate of the Ternadin anyway, he turned his attention to the 2 ships that were under his command. The Earl Mechadon was launching dropships regularly, so far having escaped attack by the enemy SD platforms. Ross tapped a finger to the display of his console without thinking about what he was doing. He and his headquarters staff had been quartered aboard the ship they called the Old MacDonald, and he was heartened to see that ship still intact and providing cover for the landing operation.
The Tig McDonough was in a different situation. That assault carrier had been struck twice by X-ray lasers. And even through the staticky sensor feed, he could see the Big Mac had its nose tilted away from the planet, its engines burning hard to gain altitude. The urgency with which the ship's captain wanted to reach jump distance was evident from the long flames firing out from the booster motors at the ship's aft end. Those boosters, which could only be used once before they had to be replaced, were rarely used, and always used only when there was no other choice. Where the hell were the battleships, and what was the task force commander doing about the murderous SD platforms that he had declared did not exist? The Dahl Ternodon had been fired on three times before that ship was torn apart, and the Big Mac had been struck twice already. A bad sign for... The Big Mac flared as an X-ray laser beam burned right through weakened shields, armor plating, and structural frames to slice the assault carrier in two pieces.
Admiral!
The 7th Fleet Commander's Chief of Staff called for attention, tearing the commander away from the vital task of searching for the enemy SD satellites.
What is it? Admiral Kuhn snapped irritably.
The McDonough has been destroyed, and the Mechadon just took a hit.
Kuhn was momentarily paralyzed with shock. There would be an inquiry after the battle, an investigation of how such a disaster could have befallen the task force. If Kuhn could stop the slaughter, the landing force could still win the day, and he could quietly slip away to an enforced but officially voluntary retirement. If he lost another assault carrier, especially if both of the carriers transporting the human expeditionary force were lost, his fate would be handled publicly rather than quietly. The McDonough was already gone, doomed to a fiery death by crashing on the planet below. But if he could prevent the destruction of the Mechadon... Kuhn scanned the display, highlighting the stricken Earl Mechadon and appraising that ship's orbital track and velocity.
Sir, we...
Kuhn held up a thumb for silence as he switched the display to the warships that surrounded the planet, warships that had failed to protect the all-important assault carriers. He reached a decision.
Signal the Voltana and the Tularas.
The battleship Voltana appeared out of a burst of gamma rays less than 80 kilometers from the assault carrier Earl Mechadon as that ship slowly turned to throw off the aim of the enemy SD network. The crews of both ships knew the Mechadon's maneuver had little chance of succeeding. The bulky carrier was flying too low and slow to dodge a laser beam fired from only a few light seconds away. If the enemy SD network followed the same strike pattern that had already claimed the Ternodon and the McDonough, their sister ship would be hit again within seconds. With the Voltana traveling at a higher speed than the assault carrier, the time when it could provide cover was short, even with the battleship's engines straining to slow its headlong rush past the Mechadon. In a dangerous action that only happened because it was a direct order from the task force commander, the battleship extended its shields to their maximum extent, covering a wider area of space, but weakening the field strength. The crew of the Voltana prayed as they waited out the 31 seconds until their ship would no longer be between the assault carrier